have such a dramatic reduction in the number of people coming across illegally, the numbers for deportation are also going to be way down.
A family in Detroit gets detained at a border crossing for 5 days.
We'll tell you the story this Friday, March 28th on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. As measles continues to spread in 5 states, there are small signs of vaccine enthusiasm.
Our call center was inundated with calls about MMR vaccine. Is their child up to date? Should they get another vaccine?
Also, fatty acids found on Mars. Could this be a sign of possible past life on the planet?
We're really living kind of a science fiction film, if you will, here. It's just amazing that we can even do this.
And a city in India that has produced some of the world's best chess players.
Those stories and more after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Hurst. Vice President Vance made a quick visit to a U.S. military base in Greenland today amid controversy over President Trump's plans to gain control of the Danish island territory. Trump says the U.S. needs Greenland for national security.
We need Greenland, very importantly, for international security. We have to have Greenland. It's not a question of, do you think we can do without it? We can't. If you look at Greenland right now, if you look at the waterways, you have Chinese and Russian ships all over the place.
But polls show most Greenlanders oppose the idea. The law firm Jenner & Block is suing to stop President Trump's executive order targeting at security clearances and government contracts. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports it's the second time a big law firm has gone to court over Trump's bid to punish them.
The Jenner firm says Trump's executive order threatens its clients and the legal system itself. In a new lawsuit filed in federal court in Washington, D.C., the big law firm says Trump's order violates First Amendment protections for free speech and association. The president called out Jenner & Block for employing a prominent Trump critic who once investigated Trump, and for its pro bono work to help immigrants and LGBTQ people. A spokesman for the firm says they expect to prevail in court and quickly. A pair of other prominent big law firms have sought to reach settlements with the White House, but Jenner says capitulating is not in its DNA. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
And today, Trump announced the law firm Skadden, Arp, Slate, Meager & Flom agreed to provide $200 million in pro bono work for causes that Trump supports to avoid an executive order targeting its business. The Red Crescent and civil defense in Gaza are demanding answers from Israel's military about the whereabouts of a crew of 15 who are heading into Rafah to rescue people from Israeli airstrikes and advancing ground troops. NPR's Aya Batraoui has more.
Israel's military released a statement saying its soldiers shot at, quote, suspicious vehicles, killing a number of Hamas militants overnight on Sunday. The military says after an initial inquiry, it determined that some of the vehicles were ambulances and fire trucks. These findings were announced 5 days after the crew of 15 went missing. The statement offers no further details on the fate of the crews inside. Gaza's civil defense spokesman Mahmoud Bassel says the body of one missing rescue crew worker has so far been found, apparently buried in the sand by an Israeli bulldozer. And he says based on what they've been able to gather from the scene, there are likely no survivors. The Red Crescent says it's found only 4 destroyed ambulances that it too says were buried in the sand. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
Stocks sharply lower on Wall Street amid concerns about inflation, weak consumer sentiment, and President Trump's changing tariff threats. The Dow down 715 points. This is NPR. A powerful magnitude 7.7 earthquake rocked Myanmar and neighboring Thailand today, destroying buildings and bridges and killing at least 150 people, mostly in Myanmar. Hundreds are injured. Officials in Myanmar say it struck this afternoon and it was felt more than 600 miles away in Thailand. Red Cross Program Coordinator Marie Manrique says there are concerns about how rescuers would be able to reach some affected areas.
It's a developing emergency and our priority is to ensure that affected communities receive the help that they need as quickly as possible. And we stand by as the IFRC, ready to scale up our support as the needs become clearer and access allows.
The area has been hit with several aftershocks, including one with a magnitude of 6.4. High egg prices in the U.S. have led to more attempts to bring in eggs into the country illegally. NPR's Bill Chappell has more.
Customs and Border Protection said this week that seizures of raw eggs have risen by 48% on the northern and southern U.S. borders compared to last year. In San Diego, the CBP field office reported 158% more seizures of eggs, a trend sparked by the bird flu outbreak. As those figures go up, another important number is going down. The Trump administration often cites smuggling of the deadly opioid fentanyl as one reason to impose tariffs on Canada and Mexico. But the CBP says interceptions of fentanyl have been falling. Last month, there were 63 fentanyl interceptions, among the fewest in at least 3 years. Bill Chappell, NPR News.
And I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew Dzingel. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. Weather tonight, rain that could turn into freezing rain, lows 26 to 29 degrees.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Immigration rights advocates say that the Trump administration is pushing the limits of what is legal when it comes to immigration enforcement. NPR's Jasmine Garst is following the case of a family in Detroit who made a mistake while driving to the supermarket. A wrong exit turned into a five-day-long ordeal for a mom without legal status and her two young children who are U.S. citizens. The family says it felt like a kidnapping. Jasmine Garst joins us now. Hi, Jazz.
Hi.
So tell us what happened to this family.
So, okay, this is a mixed status family. The mom is a woman named Sarai. She's an immigrant from Guatemala without legal status, and she requested her last name be withheld because she is afraid of retaliation. Mm-hmm. Her two daughters are ages 1 and 5. They are American citizens. They live in Detroit. And so on a Saturday morning earlier this month, Sarai and her daughters got into the car to go to Costco, you know, buy some groceries, get some lunch. Mm-hmm. But Sarai says she typed in the wrong Costco location in her phone's navigation. She realized too late she was driving to the Costco on the other side of the border in Canada.
Wow.
Which led to their arrest by Customs and Border Protection.
Okay. And I guess so far this sounds like what's been standard immigration practice for years now, right? Like someone in the country illegally gets detained at a border crossing.
Yeah. Yes, yes. In prior years, Sarai, who has no criminal record, would likely be released with a notice to appear in immigration court. But that's not what happened. Instead, they were all taken to a Customs and Border Protection building right by the border between the toll plaza and the bridge that connects Windsor, Canada, and Detroit. And they were held there for over 5 days in an office space with no windows, a space that is not built for detention, much less for children. Mm. And at no point were they allowed to speak to a lawyer or to her consulate. I spoke about this experience with Sarai.
Yo les decía, quiero un abogado que, porque ustedes mismos han dicho que también puedo tener abogado.
She says, I would tell the agents, I want a lawyer. You told me when you arrested me that I could have a lawyer. She says it felt like a kidnapping. And she says around the third day in detention, both kids started getting sick. It was quite cold in the facilities. They were mostly being fed instant ramen. And she says she started pleading with agents, please release my daughters, who again are American citizens.
Right. Well, have immigration officials responded to NPR about this whole case?
Yes. In a statement, Customs and Border Protection told NPR, quote, when individuals violate immigration laws, their choices make them subject to detention and removal. And they say Sarai's initial decision to keep her kids with her extended her detention time. Now, what happened to this family may have been legal under U.S. law, and the agency says it followed protocol, but lawyers NPR interviewed say this raises serious questions. Her children were held in conditions the U.S. has previously deemed unacceptable to minors.
God, I'm just wondering, like, how often are cases like this one happening? Do we have any idea?
Immigration lawyers I spoke to told me they believe this is becoming a more widespread practice during Trump's second term, and that it's an example of enforcement pushing the boundaries of the law. I mean, for example, typically detentions at ports of entry are very temporary, a couple of hours, maybe a day. For this family, it was close to a week without a lawyer, which is a right for everyone in the U.S., regardless of immigration status.
That is NPR's Jasmine Gars. Thank you so much, Jazz.
Thanks for having me.
This is the final week of Ramadan, a sacred month for Muslims. It's a time for fasting during the day and feasts in the evening with family. In Gaza, Ramadan this year has been spent among rubble, evacuating areas under Israeli assault and burying loved ones. NPR producer Anas Baba reports from Gaza.
It's 2 a.m. Three young men are walking through one of Gaza's destroyed neighborhoods. One beats a drum, carried over his shoulder. The other two sing Islamic chants. They're loud, and that's the point. They are waking up people, reminding them to eat before another day of fasting begins at dawn. Ramadan in Gaza has also sounded like this. Israel resumed war in Gaza on the second week of Ramadan. Gaza health officials say airstrikes have killed nearly 1,000 people, including hundreds of children. The military ordered people to flee their homes again. A brief ceasefire had brought hope the war might end. But that hope has now been shattered. Issam Zaqout says he doesn't know whether to flee his home or stay. He says this is psychological warfare. People are struggling to find food. Israel allowed humanitarian aid to flow into Gaza during the brief ceasefire. But for the past month, it's imposed a blockade on Gaza, barring all aid, even food, from entering. Israel says it's to pressure Hamas. Rights groups say it's collective punishment for civilians. Aid groups are now rationing supplies. The United Nations is pulling staff out of Gaza. Hungry and tired people gather in front of a community kitchen. Fouad Nassar says before the war, he would break his fast with chicken, fish, and kebabs. Now, he spends 2 hours in line for beans. Rana Al-Abadi is using canned food to cook a meal among piles of concrete debris. Her apartment building was destroyed in an Israeli strike. Before the war, Palestinian dishes of spiced chicken, rice, and vegetables were served every night of Ramadan. But now, she's making pizza using canned food, mushrooms, corn, sauce, and cheese. She removed the microwave's insides and turned it into an oven. Lighting a fire using foam from bed mattresses her husband collected from under the rubble around the neighborhood. A lot of burnt foam sticks to her pizza dough. That's what her children will eat tonight. She wants to make them happy any way she can. She has no other choice. She says before, Ramadan was full of variety, colors, and flavors. Now, we barely have anything. At the beginning of the holy month, some families gathered outdoors for free Ramadan meals organized by an Egyptian charity. Now, daily Israeli airstrikes make it too dangerous to gather like this. And in war, there is nothing to celebrate. But during that 1 week of Ramadan, families were able to gather together after months of displacement. They lost so much, but children played. It was quality time with the vibe of a family reunion. just one moment where they could forget everything and enjoy a Ramadan meal together without war. For NPR News, I'm Anas Baba in Gaza.
So, a science experiment aboard NASA's Curiosity rover has found tantalizing traces of possible past life on Mars.
We're really living kind of a science fiction film, if you will, here. It's just amazing that we can even do this.
Daniel Glavin is an astrobiologist with NASA. Cool job. And he's part of the team that has detected the largest organic molecules ever found on the red planet.
The molecules came from a sample of 3.7 billion-year-old Martian mudstone dug up in Gale Crater, the site of an ancient lake. Glavin says the compounds could be the remnants of what's called fatty acids.
Well, what's a fatty acid? These are components of cells, and the cell membrane includes fatty acids. So these are really important and critical building blocks of life.
But before you get too excited, there could be other explanations for where these things came from.
They could have been delivered to Gale Crater by meteorites. They can also be formed by kind of natural geological processes. And then the third possibility is that we're looking at the ancient chemical remnants of life, that biology actually built these fatty acids.
He says there's only one way to know for sure.
A next logical step here is to bring back samples from Mars, bring them home so we can finally get at this age-old question about whether or not there was ever life on Mars.
Doing so will be a journey, but that's nothing new for Glavin. This new discovery took more than a decade to come to fruition.
We first drilled this ancient Martian mudstone sample in May of 2013. And here we are now, almost 13 years later, where we're finally able to report the discovery.
Their findings appear in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
So, what's next? Well, the first part of that sample return mission, it's already underway. A different Mars rover called Perseverance landed on the planet back in 2021, and it's been collecting tubes of dust and rock and packing them in its belly.
Sometime in the future, another spacecraft will land on Mars, take those tubes, and blast into Martian orbit. Then a second spacecraft will rendezvous in orbit, bring the samples back to Earth, and drop them in Utah. Well, that's the plan, at least.
If everything goes perfectly, this would happen in the mid-2030s, 2035. But again, a lot has to go right. The only thing that we've done here is we've demonstrated we can land on Mars. So launching off the surface of Mars, orbiting with a sample in Mars orbit, rendezvousing, capturing it. All that is basically the first time we would ever demonstrated that.
So it may be a while before scientists on Earth have Mars dust in their hands. But the fact that these molecules endured billions of years on Mars, that indicates any traces of past life can probably wait a few more years, right? Until Earthlings figure out how to bring these samples home.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Coming up next is your daily dose of phonology. We receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a lifestyle magazine since 1997, a local publication sharing stories from the heart of Minnesota about the places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. LakeCountryJournal.com. Now it's time for your daily dose of phonology.
Today's date, March 28, 2005, the great blue herons returned. This is the average date for the returning of the great blue herons. The earliest that I have recorded is on the 17th of March in 1995, and the latest was on April 4th in 2001. The interesting thing about great blue herons is that they are remarkably reliable. When I look at all of my records, 33 years of records, only three of those dates fall outside the boundaries of the returning dates for blue herons. The 21st of March, twice, the 17th of March, once. Other than that, all other return dates are from March 24th to April 4th. And that's pretty astonishing. That's a pretty narrow range for returning birds. If you look at robins over that same period, their dates run from as early as March 6th to as late as April 10th. The great blue herons obviously have a different trigger for migration, and it has to be day length because they are over 33 years remarkably consistent.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Dignity Memorial, helping families today to protect their loved ones tomorrow. Planning celebrations of life in advance can give families peace of mind. Learn more at dignitymemorial.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Measles is now spreading in five states: Texas, New Mexico, Kansas, Ohio, and Oklahoma. Most of the cases are in West Texas, which reported today that they have had 400 cases since the outbreak started. Measles spreads quickly in communities with low vaccination rates, and vaccine hesitancy has been on the rise for years. But now, some pediatricians are seeing vaccine enthusiasm. NPR's Maria Godoy is here to tell us more. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so what are the latest numbers we're seeing right now on measles?
Well, today, Texas reported 77 new cases just since Tuesday, which just goes to show how contagious measles is.
Health
officials there are expecting more cases. And as you noted, the virus is now spreading in other states. New Mexico has 44 cases. Kansas has 23. So there's concern that the virus will keep spreading.
And do most cases involve people who are not vaccinated?
Correct. The vast majority are not vaccinated. But here's something interesting. While we're hearing a lot about parents who don't want to vaccinate their kids, pediatricians I've been talking to are also hearing from worried parents who want their kids to get their vaccines early.
What do you mean by early?
So normally kids get their first measles vaccine between 12 and 15 months and then a second dose between 4 and 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
But the CDC says in certain situations you can get the measles vaccine as young as 6 months, like if you're traveling abroad or are in an outbreak area. I spoke with Dr. Shannon Fox-Levine. She's a pediatrician in Broward County, Florida.
Our call center was inundated with calls about, you know, MMR vaccine. Is their child up to date? Should they get another vaccine? Should they get an extra one? Can they get it early?
And this is in Florida, where vaccine hesitancy has been growing. So Fox-Levine says hearing vaccine enthusiasm is exciting.
Why do you think there has been an uptick in enthusiasm?
Well, two things. Parents are watching what's happening with these outbreaks, and they're worried that measles will spread to where they live. You know, it is spring break season now, so people are traveling, and if you have kids who are too young for the vaccine, you might worry that you could run into someone with measles or that someone with measles could travel to your community.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the concerns pediatricians are hearing, but there's also politics at play.
What do you mean? Like, what kind of politics?
Well, several pediatricians told me they're hearing from parents who are worried about the future of vaccine access. These are parents who watch the news. They know that Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been a longtime critic of vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
Here's Dr. Susan Sirota. She's a pediatrician in the Chicago area.
There's a bit of fear among moms and dads and parents about their ability to protect their children and to prevent diseases because vaccine access is in question for them.
And, you know, it's not just the measles vaccine. Sirota says some patients are worried about access to the HPV vaccine, which protects against cervical cancer. Kennedy has been involved in legal challenges to that vaccine. Now, during his confirmation hearing, Kennedy said he wouldn't take vaccines away from anyone. He's called them a personal choice. We did reach out to HHS for comment. They did not respond.
That is NPR's Maria Godoy. Thank you so much, Maria.
My pleasure.
The southern Indian city of Chennai has produced some of the world's most formidable chess players. Reporter Omkar Khandekar traveled there to learn more.
It's a standing ovation for a new chess prodigy. 26-year-old Arvind Chidambaram crowned as the winner at Chennai Grandmasters tournament last year. Fans rushed to the door to catch him. They want selfies and autographs. The tournament organizers form a human chain so players can leave without being mobbed. Chess isn't just popular in India. Many here are good at it. 6 Indians rank among the world's top 25. And at the World Chess Championship last December...
Takes him bishop d5! And Gukesh will be the world champion!
Indian national Gukesh Domaraju became the youngest ever world champion at age 18. This is a remarkable shift for the chess world. After decades of Russian and European dominance, the spotlight is on India. And within India, one city is chess ground zero, Chennai, hometown of two world champions, and a place that chess trainer V. Sarvanan calls the factory of Indian chess.
Chess in Chennai is grown by a proper system of teaching from the grassroots.
Sarvanan says people in Chennai take chess very seriously. Some schools grant promising players holidays to train and travel. Local businesses pay their expenses. But perhaps the city's greatest asset is parents. Typically, Indian parents don't encourage their kids to pursue sports professionally. Chess is different. Sarvanan again.
In India, we have this basic belief among parents that our way to happiness and prosperity is through academics. Chess, in some respects, resembles academics.
So in recent years, chess clubs have mushroomed across the city.
Have you finished the homework?
One of those chess clubs is run by Vishnu Prasanna. He says the success of some of his students, like the current world champion Gukesh Domaraju, has turbocharged enrollments.
We had a 3.5-year-old kid who was walking in yesterday to train with us, and parents are also viewing it, right? So they would love if the kid is playing chess.
Some of them really want their kids to play chess. One father, Suresh Dasrathan, shared his 6-year-old son's daily routine. Wake up at 7, an hour of chess practice, then school, then an hour of chess coaching at the club, then homework, and bedtime at 9 p.m. Dasrathan says he wants his son to make it international.
If he is good in chess, definitely I will bring him to the next level and take him to the international podium. That is my dream.
His dream. But it's down to the kids to make their parents' dreams come true. On the day of Chennai Grandmasters tournament, we met Ravina, a 6-year-old chess student whose mother asked that we only use her first name because of her age.
They will force the kids to win and they will tell, I will give you dinner only if you win this game. And then some kids will just cry if they don't win.
It's a striking contrast to just a few decades ago when India's first chess champion was growing up in Chennai. Vishwanathan Anand is a 5-time world champion who even bested Russian legend Garry Kasparov. He says in the 80s, chess in India was seen as a hobby.
In those days, the question was all sports were nice hobbies to have, and then the parents quickly guided you back to your studies the closer you got to the end of school because you need a real job.
He says parents are taking chess more seriously now because it is something you can make a living from. The Indian government often gives champion players a job in the public sector. High-ranking players can win prize money in a newly launched global chess league. Many also work as chess coaches. Player and coach Srinath Narayanan says that's why Indian parents drive their kids so hard.
There is a massive supply of people and very limited opportunities. And something like sport is also seen as a way to jump that queue.
And even if players don't make it to the top,
even if you don't end up making it big in chess, it is still helpful for you in whatever your primary career is.
Their primary career, which more often than not is by going through the grind of academics. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, Chennai.
This is NPR News.
Plainclothes federal agents have arrested international students and academics who engaged in political protests supporting Gaza. Former Education Secretary John B. King Jr. says the arrests are chilling.
You don't want people to be afraid to speak up, and you don't want people to be afraid to come to the United States to study.
I'm Emily Kwong, and that's All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on member-supported KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. Support comes from the New Musical Theater Exchange for the world premiere of a new musical, Water from Snow, April 5th through April 13th at Rail River Folk School in Bemidji, featuring original music and area performers telling a story set in rural Minnesota. Tickets available at Four Pines Bookstore or Eventbrite.com. More info on Facebook. KAXE is working on a new series called Unplugged. What questions do you have about KAXE? Maybe it's funding, news standards, or how music is chosen. Text us at 218-326-1234. Read the first two articles at KAXE.org. The Minnesota DNR is reminding us to use extreme caution on area lakes. With fluctuating temperatures and rain, ice can deteriorate quickly.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Six tribes have formed a coalition to protect Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in southern Utah. As David Condos reports for the Mountain West News Bureau, the group's working to conserve tribal homelands.
President Donald Trump shrunk both Grand Staircase Escalante and nearby Bears Ears National Monument in 2017 during his first term. And some people worry history could repeat itself. Hank Stevens is a member of the Intertribal Coalition and part of Utah's Navajo Nation.
With that new administration coming in, you know, there's concerns that we're probably going to have two monuments being shrunk again.
The administration issued an order last month to review national monuments as part of a push to expand gas production and mining on federal lands. Still, Stevens is optimistic the federal government will collaborate with the coalition and make sure Native voices are heard. I'm David Condos.
When you've served 17 years in tribal government, what's the next step? Well, if you're Jason Harris, you start a food truck. Brian Bull talked to the former Catawba assistant chief, whose business, Bow and Arrow, roams South Carolina.
Harris and his wife, Melissa, have both worked in tribal government and still consider themselves ambassadors of a sort. Only instead of discussing policy over the table, they share Catawba history and culture over the counter.
One of the things that we have not been good at, especially as Catawbas, we don't share our culture as well as we probably should. So that's kind of given us an opportunity to answer people's questions. You know, not only the food, that's just a starting point, but we can actually get into other conversations. It helps bring our communities together even more.
Many visitors to the Bow and Arrow are non-natives, so Harris feels this is a great way to connect with others. The menu has fry bread as the basis for its entrees.
We have the Bow, which is a ground beef-based Indian taco with the trimmings that go with that. Then we have the Arrow, which is chicken on fry bread. Then we have a bison Indian taco. We hadn't seen a whole lot of that out there in Indian country. And then we do a strawberry dish that is my wife's grandmother's recipe, and it is just out of this world.
The Catawba are South Carolina's only federally recognized tribe, so Harris says it's great to represent his culture and share his passion for good food at the same time.
We get to feed people. Everybody's got to eat. And then we get to share a little bit of our culture, too. So it's been really nice to do that.
The Harris's black and turquoise truck roams the areas on and near the Catawba Reservation, sharing Native cuisine to powwow crowds and passersby alike. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
It's all aboard the victory train for Indigenous language activists in Ireland. Sho McPolin reports on signs of hope at the island's largest integrated transportation hub.
Chucky or la, get the Brits out, lad, a one-way ticket, please, I've lost my bus pass.
It's been a good year for Ireland's Indigenous language. The Irish hip-hop band Kneecap is showcasing the 2,500-year-old language at high-profile festivals this year like Coachella and Glastonbury. And this week in Kneecap's hometown of Belfast, officials in charge of the new Grand Central Station announced plans to install signage with Irish in addition to the King's English. Irish language equality has become a political tool in the historically violent showdown between those who favor a united Ireland and those who wish to keep Northern Ireland as part of the United Kingdom. That's why a handful of far-right politicians are trying to suppress the new signs. More than 2 million people on the island, or 30% of the population, say they have some ability to speak Irish. For National Native News, I'm Sho McPolin in Ireland.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
We'll be right back.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. The Trump administration continues to move swiftly to eliminate what President Trump calls anti-American ideology from America's cultural institutions. Yesterday, the latest executive order targeted the Smithsonian and the memorials and monuments overseen by the Department of the Interior. Joining us now to unpack what's going on is NPR culture correspondent Elizabeth Blair. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
So, Elizabeth, just start if you can by telling us what this order says.
The order is called Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History. It's essentially calling for an overhaul of the Smithsonian and an evaluation of federal monuments. The Smithsonian is a vast complex that includes the Air and Space Museum, the Natural History Museum, the National Museum of the American Indian, the Cooper Hewitt in New York, and several other museums and research centers. The executive order claims that the Smithsonian has, quote, come under the influence of a divisive race-centered ideology, and then it promotes narratives that portray American and Western values as inherently harmful and oppressive. I talked to Jim Grossman, executive director of the American Historical Association. He says Trump's executive order is neither truth nor sanity.
It misrepresents the work of the Smithsonian, which is one of the great research institutions in the world. Arguing that the Smithsonian somehow misleads people, somehow is unpatriotic, somehow is saying things that are not true. That's simply not true.
Still, the order says no future federal dollars can be spent on anything at the Smithsonian that degrades, quote, shared American values. It also says that the as yet unbuilt Women's History Museum will not recognize men as women in any respect.
Elizabeth, how much authority can the U.S. president exert over the content in Smithsonian museums?
The Smithsonian is governed by a board of regents. It includes the Chief Justice of the United States and the Vice President. It also includes three senators, three representatives, and nine citizen members appointed by Congress. So while the U.S. president is not a member of the board of regents, his VP is. The executive order says the Vice President will work with Congress to appoint citizens that agree with the administration, and it threatens to withhold federal funding, which is critical to the Smithsonian.
Right. Well, what has the Smithsonian had to say about all of this?
The Smithsonian has not yet released a statement.
Okay. We also mentioned federal monuments. What does the order have to say about them?
Trump's order asked the Department of the Interior to take a look at federal monuments to make sure they don't, quote, perpetuate a false reconstruction of American history or include any other improper partisan ideology. It also calls for reinstating monuments that have been removed to improperly minimize or disparage certain historical figures or events. The Interior Department has not yet responded to NPR's request for comment, but we presume he's talking about monuments that were torn down because many people found them offensive. After the murder of George Floyd, more than 150 Confederate symbols were removed across the United States.
That was NPR's Elizabeth Blair. Elizabeth, thank you.
Thank you.
It took the cooperation of several countries last summer for the U.S. and Russia to complete the largest prisoner swap since the Cold War. Paul Whelan, a 55-year-old retired U.S. Marine, was freed in that exchange. He had been held for more than 5 years, but since returning home to Michigan, he says he still feels trapped, this time in a web of bureaucracy. WDET's Quinn Kleinfelter explains.
Last August, a crowd of reporters and photographers gathered at Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland and trained their cameras on a small plane that had just touched down. The first to emerge was a tall, light-haired man with glasses who steadied himself on the hand railings before he snapped off a crisp salute.
It was Paul Whelan, who has been serving a sentence for years.
A CNN announcer described Whelan's actions.
Now embracing the President of the United States of America after a lengthy conversation as he's turning his head towards the family members that await him, waving back to the crowd as America waves back. United.
But Whelan says the excitement about his return soon faded.
What we found is that once you're home, you're actually on your own. You know, the attention turns on the next guy that's still locked up somewhere abroad.
Whelan was arrested on false espionage charges in December of 2018 and waited years to be freed while the U.S. negotiated the release of other American captives. After the first year of his detention, his employer, BorgWarner, cut his job as director of global security and his insurance coverage. When he finally arrived home, Whelan found that he did not qualify for unemployment because he had not worked in Michigan recently.
Well, I was working, but I was working in a Russian labor camp, and that apparently doesn't count.
A member of Congress had to contact Michigan's Secretary of State just for Whelan to get a driver's license and identification. And being convicted of a crime in Russia, even a crime the U.S. government declared was bogus, created problems.
When I applied for a renewal of my global entry card, which comes from Customs and Border Patrol, I had a hard time with them because they kept focusing on the fact that, well, you were arrested and you were imprisoned overseas. And I said, yeah, and look at the pictures of the president meeting me at Andrews Air Force Base when I came back.
Strangest of all, he says, was when he tried to get full Medicaid coverage through the state.
I had applied for medical care and I had a letter back saying that I didn't qualify because I wasn't a U.S. citizen. It makes you scratch your head, to be quite honest. I mean, how could somebody have sent that to me? But they did. And I said, you know, you could just Google my name right now.
It's not supposed to be that difficult for returning hostages. Congress created the Levinson Act specifically to provide medical and other help to them and their families for 5 years after their release. But Congress never funded it. Michigan Congresswoman Haley Stevens says there's a bipartisan effort to add that appropriation.
Someone like Paul Whelan, 5.5 years taken from him. If he was wrongfully in prison in the United States, he'd arguably get compensation. Paul Whelan right now is living off of a GoFundMe, and it's unacceptable, and it's wrong.
Whelan lives with his elderly parents in the small village of Manchester, roughly 60 miles southwest of Detroit, and he says he literally depends on the kindness of strangers. At the Manchester Diner, owner Leslie Kirkland has a job tip, offering to connect Whelan with a regular customer who runs a cybersecurity company.
Try and talk to him this weekend. I know he'll come in for chicken and waffles, and I can see if he's got something for you or he can put you in the right direction for something.
Whelan smiles, then glances at his phone. He's just got a message from another former hostage, one of several who text each other regularly, seeking advice and encouragement.
It's a small community, but we keep in touch. Sort of like a group of misfit toys.
Whelan talks about support he's received from the community, the car dealers who've offered him a leased vehicle, and the private practitioners that provided him with some medical and dental help.
But the reality is that when you get off the plane, you find that your former life isn't there. The homes that we've left are not the homes that we come back to. It's a process of putting puzzle pieces together yourself.
Whelan says if he can help the government develop new methods to support anyone else who might be detained, maybe his half decade in the darkest corners of the Russian prison system will count for more than just time taken away from him. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Today brings the first of three funerals for the teenage victims of last Friday's mass shooting in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Three of four suspects arrested are also teens, and New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham is telling state lawmakers to expect a special legislative session focused on public safety. Johnny Coker with member station KRWG in Las Cruces reports, and a warning, the story includes the sound of gunshots.
The shooting happened at what Las Cruces police are calling an unsanctioned car show at Young Park, a popular live music and events venue. The meetups have become common at the park. Enthusiasts show off their vehicles and sometimes skid around the parking lot in chaotic and dangerous fashion, as shown in this video obtained by Las Cruces police. These car shows have prompted police intervention in the past. Last Friday, an altercation at one of the meetups turned into a barrage of gunfire, as recorded in cell phone video also cited by police.
Oh no!
Three teenagers were shot and killed. 15 others were wounded. 21-year-old Zaniah Hernandez was at the event with her brother.
They did shoot our car. They did get our car and our tire. I mean, I'm okay. My brother's okay.
Four suspects have been arrested so far, three of them juveniles. Hernandez says the event was packed.
And then out of nowhere, just people were dead, families are hurt. And
New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham says there needs to be a special state legislative session on public safety in wake of the shooting. She tried one last year. It only lasted 5 hours, and lawmakers bypassed most of her agenda. Lujan Grisham called it, quote, one of the most disappointing days in her career.
Police chiefs from across the state and the New Mexico Association of Chiefs of Police have been screaming from the rooftops about a very serious juvenile violent crime problem we have in New Mexico.
This is Las Cruces Police Chief Jeremy Story at a press conference a few days after the shooting.
This is not about politics, but it is about policy.
Story has been advocating for criminal justice reform since last year. He wants lawmakers to make it easier for district attorneys to try juveniles as adults for some serious crimes.
DAs across New Mexico have been sounding the alarm on juvenile crime, yet nothing meaningful was accomplished at our last legislative session to address these dire concerns.
Governor Lujan Grisham has not yet formally called a new special session. Meanwhile, Las Cruces mourns.
It's your man, King Alas, so we pour out our praise. Pour out our praise, it's your prayer.
Local pastor Joshua De La O helped organize this vigil for victims shortly after the shooting.
Even if people weren't involved and weren't there, there's always a sense of insecurity, a sense of fear. So even that, overcoming that as a community, we have a lot of work ahead of us there.
The three people killed in the shooting were 16-year-old Andrew Madrid, 18-year-old Jason Gomez, and 19-year-old Dominic Estrada. A memorial for one of the victims is today, followed by a vigil organized by a local social justice nonprofit. Zaniah Hernandez, who witnessed the shooting, says car meets like the one it happened at aren't the problem.
We can still have fun. We can still get together. We can show off our cars without families getting hurt, without people, you know, dropping to the ground.
For NPR News, I'm Johnny Coker in Las Cruces, New Mexico.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is The Setlist on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at Friday and Saturday, March 28th and 29th, with shows in Aiken, Duluth, Grand Rapids, and Bemidji. First up, a duo called Sawtooth Witch will be at Santa Rita in Aiken Friday night at 6 p.m. With Pat Doc Dougherty on guitar and Haley Fleming on violin, both sharing vocals, they make acoustic dance rock and formerly released music under the name They Self. The show begins at 6 p.m. It's Friday night, Sawtooth Witch at Santa Rita in Aiken. At 7:30, alt-rock singer-songwriter Mary Bew is celebrating the release of her new album at Sacred Heart Music Center in Duluth. Bew will be performing with a full band behind the new album, The Wildness of Living and Dying, which showcases her intimate and intense songwriting. Opening the show is folk singer and violinist Galen Lee. It's this Friday at Duluth at Sacred Heart. On Saturday, Lonesome Dan Case is part of a new duo playing at Rapids Brewing in Grand Rapids at 6 p.m. Kismet Rendezvous features old-timey singer Dawn Tanner alongside Lonesome Dan, playing a mix of Americana and blues. It is Saturday night in Grand Rapids. And the final featured show of the set list is jam funk band Kitschy Boogie at Headwaters Music and Arts in Bemidji. The group features Shane Corning and Jason Dowell on guitar and vocals, Doug Quance on drums, and Papa Steve Ross on bass. The show is a benefit for Headwaters Scholarship Programs, and their school band will open the evening at 6 o'clock. Kitschy Boogie at Headwaters Music and Arts this Saturday. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and we'll post the latest edition every Wednesday at kaxc.org.
News. This is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. All right, here is something that you probably hear a lot when someone talks about a book that got made into a movie. The book is better, to the point that it's honestly pretty impressive when a movie can come close or even surpass the original source material. Why is that? And is it even true? I don't know. To talk about it, I brought in two people I love talking about books with. It is NPR's Book of the Day podcast host, Andrew Limbong. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, what's up, Scott?
And NPR editor, Barry Hardiman. Hey, Barry.
Hey, how's it going?
Why don't we start with both of you with that first question? The book is always better than the movie. True or false, Barry?
Utterly false. Utterly false. And in fact, I try really hard not to say the book was better when I have that feeling. I try to say, oh, have you also read the book? Because there are so many wonderful adaptations. Mm-hmm. And I really feel kind of strongly that we should not, as a book lover, do not be that person. And in general, the whole idea is that there's two creative enterprises, right? There's the person who wrote the book, which is its own thing, and then the person who wrote the screenplay and then conceived of the light and the acting and all that other stuff. They're different.
Andrew, are you going to agree or disagree?
I don't live in absolutes. I don't think...
Then why are you even here?
Yeah, come on. Let's get some hot takes. I don't think... I obviously think it's decidedly different. I will say, if you have a feeling, a certain emotional attachment to a book, it's kind of hard to watch a movie and have someone else's take be that take. And so I understand where the inclination comes from. I just think it's incorrect.
I think we can all agree... It is hard, especially like the bigger a book is, the harder it is to create a movie out of it. Why do you think that is?
There's a certain amount of ego death and there's a certain amount of egoism, right? As it, depending on, you know, the sort of like background, what kind of like hands the author generally doesn't have that much to say over it. But I think if they like have to necessarily kill themselves, like not literally, obviously, in order to just like let this bird fly. And then also you as a filmmaker have to have enough ego to say, hey, you know that book I really loved? I'm going to change it drastically in order to fit this different medium.
Yeah, I will say, I think that there's faithful and there's loyal, right? Like there are sort of two different ways to think about how much you're going to try to hold on to the word by word versus the intention. And then you lose like the possibility of creative genius. Like one of the great things about the Gen X Romeo and Juliet, the Leonardo DiCaprio one, is that it actually does something I've never seen on stage. And I'm calling this a book in this case. But I've never seen where Juliet wakes up before Leonardo actually dies. So they have a moment where they connect. I've never seen that on stage.
Poison. Don't call and left no friendly drop to help me after.
Talk about ability to like to have real ego on the filmmaker's part. Baz Luhrmann, lots of that. And say, I have this real idea and I'm going to do something different than William, I want to say.
Frickin' Shakespeare.
Yeah. Exactly. I couldn't think
I
of
did. I did. I tried to watch his Great Gatsby movie with Leo in it. Mm. Bro, I had to...
Actually, my eighth grader said the same thing.
So setting that Great Gatsby movie aside, past quarter century have given us a lot of examples of really iconic books that become iconic movies, and they live together in different ways. Like you could argue the Lord of the Rings trilogy, the movies expanded on it. They made it a bigger cultural thing. They became their own thing that I think some would argue supplanted. I am actually somebody who like actually ignores the movies and loves the books and repeatedly rereads the books.
Forgot.
I appreciate the movies. I'm not a hater on the movies. They just don't have the same attachment for me, even though I'm like the exact age of people who love the movies. Right. So there's that. There's the Harry Potter movies, which I think they're kind of like dual tracks, you know. Mm. And then let's throw another example in Twilight, where I feel like the movies just like did not hit the books in the same level. Like, what do you think these tell us about like when it works when it doesn't work. Maybe you disagreed with everything I said.
No, I just, well, first of all, I'm trying to think of a way not to say that I think that the Lord of the Rings movies are better.
That's fair.
Straight to your face.
It's fair.
Because I really do think they improve on the books. And I know the books are beloved and important. But the other one is I think that the first Twilight movie is much better than the book. In fact, it's a great example of when the source material is beloved, but maybe a little not as sharp. Mm-hmm. You know, the books were a moment, but they aren't like high art in and of themselves. Mm-hmm. And
I think
so,
that's a fair statement.
Yeah, but I actually think that the first one is great. There's tons of chemistry.
I know what you are.
Say it.
Vampire.
They gave the book something that they didn't actually have.
I think we don't often think of the MCU movies as literary adaptations.
Ooh. Most of the intelligence community doesn't believe he exists. The ones that do call him the Winter Soldier.
I was a kid when Winter Soldier came out, like the comic books. And those were a big deal to me. And Civil War was a big deal to me. And turning those into gigantic movies I was a comic book kid, and that all of a sudden, like, normal people, hot, good-looking people, were also into this thing that I was into. I think these adaptations of books have a way of spreading the gospel, so to speak, of what makes this stuff so good.
Yeah, no, that's such a good point.
You both talked about a couple examples, but is there any other example that you feel like is, like, the best movie to point to when it's just like, this is an adaptation? But it is far, far, far out there, like stretching the bounds of any sort of relationship at all, and yet still works.
I think for me, and this is an old one, but The French Lieutenant's Woman, which is a John Fowles book, and is the first book of, yes, I'm going to say this word, metafiction. I try not to ever say it, though. I don't. I really do. And I loved it. And the adaptation with Meryl Streep and Jeremy Irons, which I think is like an 80s adaptation, is so fascinating because, you know, the book is telling this love story in different layers, different ways it could be told. It's interacting on all these different levels. And the movie is doing it with the actors. So the actors are having this relationship at the same time that they are telling the story of the story. It's such a creative way to do it. And once you see it, you think, oh, there's no other way this movie could have been made.
I'm thinking you talked about, you said metafiction. I thought immediately about that last part in Killers of the Flower Moon, where Scorsese himself shows up.
Mrs. Molly Cobb, 50 years of age, passed away at 11 o'clock Wednesday night at her home. She was a full-blood Osage.
And kind of is like, this is the story I'm telling you, this is why I'm telling you, this is why I have to kind of like put my chips in and tell this story, which is something that, like, you know, you obviously, the David Grand book is pretty like, just the facts, ma'am, and sort of like tells it. And then him like introducing this sort of authorial intent on adapting that book, I think changes the entire movie in retrospect in a really interesting way.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I fell asleep 2.5 hours into that movie. I didn't get to this point.
No, I feel you. I had a whole popcorn situation. I had a whole strategy in.
Yeah.
Like
the
Swedish fish were not going to be opened until like 2.5 hours.
That's smart.
Hours in.
Yeah. I just did it in 2 nights.
That is NPR's Andrew Limbong and Barry Hardiman. We could have talked for another 6 hours. Thanks for coming by.
We probably will.
Great, thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting The Penguin Lessons, a new comedy starring Steve Coogan as a teacher whose life is upended after he rescues a penguin from an oil-slicked beach, now playing in theaters. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji,
89.9 Brainerd and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. My Neighbor to Love Coalition hosts an open house at New Housing Complex in Brainerd Sunday, March 30th from noon to 2. Celebrate with the families who now have a home of their own at 620th Northwest 3rd Street in Brainerd. Weather tonight, rain that could turn into freezing rain. Lows 26 to 29 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with highs in the upper 30s. Chance for mixed precipitation, especially in the Brainerd area. Northeast wind up to 20 miles per hour.